This past week, we ended our political series, Also Rans, a look at American losers, where we discussed some of the characters throughout history who could have made it to the White House but didn't. And looking back on our own archives, I've been lucky enough to speak to a few of the people who almost became president. In light of recent news in our current presidential election, we decided to pick three of those interviews for people who not only ran for president, but who are all military veterans. In 2005, I spoke with Senator Bob Dole, who served in World War II, about being wounded in Italy, his recovery, and his ascent to the Senate. In 2007, I spoke to John Kerry, who served in Vietnam, and his wife, Teresa Hines Kerry, about their fight for the environment. And one senator who's been prominent in the news today, John McCain, spoke to us in 2000 about being shot down in North Vietnam and about being a POW in Vietnam and how that changed him as a person and as a politician. We hope you like it. Before the war, Bob Dole dreamed of becoming a star athlete at the University of Kansas, but an arm shattered in battle in Italy shattered those dreams. It was only with the help of experimental drugs, maverick doctors, the love of his family, and the generosity of his small-town neighbors that he became physically and emotionally fit to embark on his long career in public service. Senator Dole is here with us to speak about those battles, which he recounts in his new memoir called One Soldier Story. It's published by HarperCollins. It's my great honor and pleasure to welcome him to my show today. Hello.
Thank you.
Can you describe what Russell, Kansas was like when you were growing up?
Well, it was like a lot of small rural towns anywhere in America. But in addition, they discovered oil in within 25 miles of Russell, in fact, about 15 miles of Russell. So we had kind of a pickup in the economy. A lot of people moved in. A lot of people found jobs. A lot of people came from other states that already had jobs. So it was a bustling community, not very big. I think when I probably born, it was about 2,000. But the time, 40s, it probably went up to 6,000-7,000. Now today it's back to 5,000.
So. And you compare it to Garrison Killis Lake Wobegon.
Well, yeah, I think because of the people there and the camaraderie, and you know, we didn't lock our doors, we didn't take the keys out of the car. Now that's done in every community, but it was just a good place to be from. Everybody knew everybody. In fact, I guess everybody knew everybody's business too.
Yeah, if your car was parked in front of a house, everybody knew that you were there.
Oh, yeah, what's this guy doing over here? Oh, yeah, okay, well, let's check it out. But you know, it's home. Yeah, I don't know wherever anybody's from, when they get home, it's a great feeling.
What would your former party members think if they knew you were listening to public radio, listening to Garrison Keillor? Don't they consider that the bastion of liberal propaganda?
Well, I think to some extent, but I enjoy public radio. I did a couple of NPR, interviews here last couple of days, and PBS. I think I'm fairly generous in my donations to PBS. So I believe more money should come from the private sector. I think we have an obligation once we're in the private sector to support NPR and PBS and everything else.
Do you go back to Russell?
Discovered oil in within 25 miles of Russell, in fact, about 15 miles of Russell. So we had kind of a pickup in the economy. A lot of people moved in. A lot of people found jobs. A lot of people came from other states that already had jobs. So it was a bustling community, not very big. I think when I probably born, it was about 2,000. But the time, 40s, it probably went up to 6,000-7,000. Now today it's back to 5,000.
So. And you compare it to Garrison Killis Lake Wobegon.
Well, yeah, I think because of the people there and the camaraderie, and you know, we didn't lock our doors, we didn't take the keys out of the car. Now that's done in every community, but it was just a good place to be from. Everybody knew everybody. In fact, I guess everybody knew everybody's business too.
Yeah, if your car was parked in front of a house, everybody knew that you were there.
Oh, yeah, what's this guy doing over here? Oh, yeah, okay, well, let's check it out. But You know, it's home. I don't know wherever anybody's from. When they get home, it's a great feeling.
What would your former party members think if they knew you were listening to public radio, listening to Garrison Keillor? Don't they consider that the bastion of liberal propaganda?
Well, I think to some extent, but I enjoy public radio. I did a couple of NPR, interviews here last couple of days, and PBS. I think I'm fairly generous in my donations to PBS. So I believe more money should come from the private sector. I think we have an obligation once we're in the private sector to support NPR and PBS and everything else.
Do you go back to Russell?
Yeah, I'll be back to Russell maybe in May, but I've been, since December, I've been in the hospital 41 days with Mr. Woodruff, and he said, you know, you're not doing too well in school. I mean, I missed a lot of classes. I never missed any farewell parties for guys that were enlisting, and my grades were suffering, and he said, well, I'm not saying it, but, you know, maybe you ought to take a look at service possibilities. In other words, you're not doing any good here once you go on. So I enlisted in the what they call the enlisted reserve at that time, and was called up 6 months later and ended up in Brooklyn College, among other places, which is not far from where we sit, but then found myself in the officer candidate school in Fort Benning, became one of those 90-day wonders, graduating from the Benning School for Boys, as we were ridiculed over the years time I was in service by some of the old-time regular Army guys.
Your brother was also...
My brother was in the service. He's staff sergeant. He ended up in New Guinea and expired about 8 years ago. He's no longer with us.
Was that the first time you were out of Russell or out of Kansas?
Yeah, I'd never been on a bus, never been on an airplane, never been... Easter of Kansas City.
And here you are in Brooklyn and in New York City.
Oh, here I attended Brooklyn College. And in fact, I visited Brooklyn College about 3 years ago, and it's pretty much the same.
I know. I went there, too.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You're a grad?
I am.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, we had a lot of fun in Brooklyn College. We thought we were all going to be engineers. That's what they were teaching us. But then there was a shortage of second lieutenants, and so we shipped to Camp Polk, Louisiana, and from there I went to Camp Breckenridge, and then from there I went to OCS. But it was a great experience living in Brooklyn and going into the city from time to time, riding the subway, going up and down Flatbush Avenue. It was, you know, quite a thing for some little guy from a small town in Kansas. This was the big one, you know. This was it.
Bob Dole has written a memoir called One Soldier's Story. It's published by HarperCollins. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. So how did you end up fighting in Italy? Could you have been sent to North Africa, or was that already over?
Well, the war was winding down. May 8th was the day it ended, and, of course, I was wounded on April 14th of 45. So you had about a three-week period there. I don't know how I got in the ski troops when I was from Kansas, which is about as flat as this table.
Were you the only person who couldn't ski in your
I probably
company?
Was. I was probably the only person in my platoon who couldn't ski, though they didn't have many ski adventures or ski experiences once they arrived in Italy. There were some, but there were very few, mostly photo opportunities where they'd go out and show these fellows on skis, and they'd be coming down the mountain. It'd end up in Stars and Stripes or some military magazine.
And then you were wounded. You were. What was that like? I've always wondered. In the movies, they do it in slow mo.
Yeah.
Did it feel like it was a slow motion experience?
It's hard to recall all of it, but we try to be accurate in our book and try to. If everything downplay what happened. I know I was felt this sting in my shoulder, and this high explosive shell sort of tore into my body. And
you don't even know whether it was a mortar shell or whether it was
mortar
a machine
or,
gun.
It had to be something, though, because I still have a lot of little scraps in the right shoulder area. So it had to be some kind of an explosive. It could have been a a rifle, could have been a carbine, could have been most a mortar shell. But whatever it was, it did a lot of damage. And
You had been trying to retrieve somebody who'd been wounded in your company, and then you had to lie in the wet ground, wounded for hours and hours until the battle was over.
Yeah, Corporal Sims was my radio man, and he had been shot, and I went out to try to bring him back to safety. I didn't know whether he was dead or alive, of course. Turned out later that he died very shortly after that. But in the process, when I felt this sting, and then I don't remember a great deal. I remember there are three or four people. One is Mr. Frank Caraffa from New Rochelle, New York, who did a lot that day, I think, to save my life. But there were a lot of casualties that day. The 10th Mountain Division took a big hit that day because sort of the last stand for many of the Germans. And once they got through this one area, you just sort of made a fast push through the Po Valley. And as I said, the war ended May 8th, and many of us ended up in hospitals, and others, even less fortunate, were killed in action.
When did you realize that you were paralyzed?
Well, I didn't. You know, at the time, I couldn't raise my arms or legs, and I asked somebody about my arms. I think it was Sergeant Caraffa, and he took my arms and folded them across my chest. That might have been Sergeant Kuschek, too, but I can't remember, but so I knew that I still had arms, but I couldn't move them. So it was probably about 11 months before I could really feed myself, about 6 months before I could walk. I had a spinal injury. It didn't sever the spine. It just bruised the spine. So, you know, you can look back on it. I was extremely fortunate that it wasn't more serious.
Well, people thought that there wasn't much hope for you at first.
Well, that's what I understand. In fact, there's a letter which I quote in my book written by a second lieutenant in Battle Creek, Michigan, where I was hospitalized, Percy Jones Army Hospital, telling my parents that I was in very bad condition. And in effect, the chances of survival were not great, and he thought they should know about it, which I thought was pretty insensitive looking back on it. I mean, it seemed to me if there's a soldier in a hospital who's very, very sick, they ought to get a telegram or a phone call so they can get there in time to see their son or daughter, whoever it might be.
Although your parents did come. And
they did come. Oh, yeah, they came.
It played a major role in saving your life because...
My mother was a star. She was barely ever left my bedside for very long when I was in Topeka, Kansas, in the hospital there. Held my cigarettes, and she hated smoke from cigarettes, but she was a very outstanding woman. Neither my father or mother completed high school, but I'm really, there's one letter in there where she writes to me about the death of President Roosevelt, which is really a very fine summation of this wonderful man. Talks about how he's going to be missed, and really she just hopes that Truman has the same stuff as Roosevelt, and you sort of get an idea of what the average person thought of FDR in those days. They revered him, as my mother did, and I never knew that until she wrote it in a letter.
She also agreed with a doctor who wanted to try an experimental drug on you. We know streptomycin now, but at the time it was an experimental drug.
Right, by Pfizer. And
it seems to have saved your life.
That's what I understand. It was very helpful. I had a pulmonary embolism.
Wait. I just have to stop you. You said by Pfizer. Is that Pfizer is the company that makes Viagra? Am I seeing
any? Oh, yeah, it's the same one.
I picked that up? Okay.
Yeah, in fact, I didn't realize that until I visited the Pfizer plant, which is in Brooklyn. They have a plant here. And they were telling me all these things that happened, and I had no idea that they were the ones who the research developed this drug. It's a very powerful drug and helped a lot of people, not just those in the armed services, once it was fully...
And why did it save... How did it save your life? It had been developed to fight tuberculosis.
Yeah,
you didn't have TB.
I wondered myself how it had an impact on... I had infection, but I also had this embolism. I don't know how it would attack an embolism. That's a mystery that I haven't solved yet, but they used it on me, and they got my parents' consent. And for whatever purpose it was given, it must have been successful because here I am today.
Well, you had a bacteria, I understand, that was resistant to penicillin and streptomycin.
I think that's the case.
But also, you probably had a very strong will. I understand that the doctors and nurses used to refer to you as a soldier who refused to die when he was supposed to.
I don't know about that. That's what somebody said. But there are a lot of people around me, and you know, in life, as you know, Leonard, you just have to, if you think you've got a bad problem, just look around. You'll find somebody else very quickly with a real problem that sort of dwarfs the one you think you may have.
The Percy Jones Army Hospital that you mentioned in Battle Creek, Michigan, is no longer a hospital and has a new name. It's a federal office complex called the Hart Dole Inouye Federal Center. That's because of the three of you who went on to serve in Congress all went through your period being treated there?
Right, yeah. Senator Dan Inouye lost his right arm and was in battle. In fact, he also had a leg injury. Phil Hart, who was Lieutenant Governor of Michigan, had a flesh wound in his, I think, the right arm, and he sort of took care of the rest of us. And we didn't know anything about politics, at least I didn't, and Dan Inouye didn't. Maybe Phil Hart might have. But he was married to Jane Briggs, whose father owned the Detroit Tigers. So,
Briggs Field, I remember that.
Engines and all this, and of course he had baseball tickets for anybody who wanted to go watch baseball. And just he was a great guy. And if you go to Washington D.C., there's an office building named after Senator Phil Hart because he had such high, he was held in such high regard.
You wound up spending 39 months total in hospital.
In and out. You know, I had some leave in there, too. So,
But the physical therapy didn't seem to work as much. It was an orthopedic surgeon who played a major role.
A wonderful man named Dr. Kalikian, an Armenian-American who sort of took me under his wing and operated on my arm and hand several times trying to help me, wouldn't let me pay him. He even operated on my mother when she came to visit for varicose veins. He said, "Oh, you have varicose veins, I fix it." And he did, and wouldn't let her pay. All I paid was the hospital bill.
And he wasn't a military doctor either.
He'd been in the military. He was a major. Mm-hmm. And he lost a brother in World War II. And his family had been part of the Armenian genocide. And so in 1915... But he's just a great guy, wrote spicy novels in his spare time. I never had a chance to read one of them, but he's no longer with us. But his son, Armin, is a practicing orthopedic surgeon in Chicago.
He told you things like, we start by not thinking so much anymore about what you have left and what you can do with it.
He, in effect, told me, Leonard, to grow up and get on with my life. You know, sort of hit you in the face with a cold towel and say, he always called me Captain. I was a first lieutenant, I think, then. But he always said, Captain, you know, get on with your life. Make the best of what you have. So I realized my wild dreams of being, playing basketball and all that stuff again were not going to happen. So I did grow up. I said, you got to get on with your life.
Now, you mentioned that he treated you without asking for any money, waived all of his fees for surgery, although you did have to pay the hospital fees. So people at the drugstore you'd worked at as a kid, as a soda jerk, put a cigar box for the Bob Dole Fund together, and they raised the money in the cigar box.
$1,800.
Now, of course, if there'd been universal health care at the time, or even right now for that matter, you might have just had it been taken care of by through insurance payments.
You could have been, but, you know, of course, we were also in the service. If there had been adequate health care, but we were constrained to using Army hospitals, and of course most of the good doctors are going home. The war was over. You couldn't blame them. They wanted to go home.
Well, that hasn't changed much because there are reports from people returning wounded from Iraq that they're facing some very high medical costs.
Well, some, but I visit Walter Reed quite often, and I can tell you I speak to them when there's no doctor around, and I must say almost to the person, They really are satisfied with the health care they receive.
My guest is Bob Dole, who has written a memoir called One Soldier's Story, published by HarperCollins. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break here on WNYC. We're back with Bob Dole, who has written not about his career in the Senate, but about his experiences during World War II and in the years following, and also at the end about a recent thing that he's had to deal with. The book is called One Soldier's Story, a memoir. It is published by HarperCollins. So you came back and you, inspired by Frank Sinatra and other things, you decided to pick up where you'd left off the best you could. You went to law school at Washburn. You gave up University of Kansas, went to Washburn in Topeka. And why law school?
Well, you know, maybe it's a simplistic response, but I couldn't use my hands. One not at all, and the other not very well. And I said, well, if I can't use my hands, I have to use my head. And so it was sort of limited my choices. And I thought, well, the law school, if I can finish it, if I'm smart enough to finish it, will help me in whatever I do. You don't have to practice law. It's just good to teach you discipline and how to deal with problems. So I gave it a shot, and I made excellent grades. I made very poor grades before I went off to the service, I'll confess. But when I came to Brooklyn College, and after I made good grades in Brooklyn College while I was still in the service, and after my service, I made excellent grades.
And then your first wife helped you get through
school.
She helped
me take
notes and everything.
She went to class.
Somebody had to write your exams.
She did, and she probably knew as much about some of those courses than I did. We also had, the government had given me a recording machine to take to class, which I would put the mic on the professor's desk, and he would... I had very good notes, which were available to my friends at exam time, so I was pretty popular then.
You became, when you decided to run for office, what, as a an attorney, the Russell County attorney?
Before that, I ran for the state legislature. My first office in 1950, I ran against a fellow, an incumbent, for the state legislature from Russell County.
And you became an accidental Republican?
Sort of accidental. My parents were Democrats. They had changed their party to help a nice lawyer in our town who ran for Congress, who was a Democrat. I came along, and a fellow named John Wolk sort of convinced me that the Republican Party was the right party. In addition, there are more Republicans in the county than Democrats. So I became a Republican.
It seems to be the way a lot of people who had returned from service decided. Richard Nixon was, I think he was unsure whether to be a...
Dan Inouye tells the story that we talked about this in the hospital, and I told him what I thought would be a good future for both of us, and he said that sort of got him interested in politics. And Dan Inouye, of course, listeners probably know, is a very outstanding senator from the state of Hawaii and a very close personal friend.
A Democrat.
A Democrat, oh, yeah. Well, we don't talk about party when we talk.
You gave Liddy, your wife, the same kind of advice that you'd received when she decided to run for office. There are more Republicans in the state, so you probably...
But in North Carolina, there are more Democrats in the state, so she didn't have the advantage that I had in that small Russell County race, but...
North Carolina has gone solidly Republican the last few elections, hasn't it?
They have a Democratic governor. That's a pretty good... and I think... I'm not sure who controls the legislature now. But it's still it's not as Republican as South Carolina, but the South is moving more and more to the Republican Party. But North Carolina is still it's not an easy state.
What led you to write these memoirs, this rather than a political memoir or something else?
Political memoir didn't make any sense to me. You know, who's interested in what Bob Dole did in the Senate?
Oh, wait. You were one of the most important figures in the Senate.
I know,
you ran for president.
Who really wants to read it? And I think there are good things, like working with Pat Moynihan, the two of us, to rescue Social Security in 1983. But, you know, people get a little tired of politics. So I went down to see a fellow in Washington, D.C. named Bob Barnett, who does a lot of books for President Clinton, Mrs. Clinton, former Vice President Dan Quayle, you know, dozens of people. And when I found these letters, he said, you've got a book here. These letters that my sister had kept all these years and told me about 2 years ago. She had 300 letters, some that I'd written, some my parents had written to me, some that other people had written for me. And that's when I decided to do the book.
Were you surprised by what you found in those letters?
Yeah, I was totally surprised.
You'd forgotten nine-tenths of it.
Who can
remember
what they did 58 years ago? I mean, I didn't forgotten about the letters, forgotten about my mother's letters, and my father only wrote about four letters in his lifetime, and I think I received one of those, though we can't find the original.
You take Tom Brokaw and others to task, although rather mildly, for calling the World War II generation the greatest generation. Why is that?
Well, I didn't take him to task. I'm proud of being part of that, but I think it's sort of like a relay race. You pass the baton to the next generation, and the present generation, in my view, are the greatest generation, the ones who risked their lives in Iraq and Afghanistan and could anywhere around the world if something happened. So I think we have to recognize that, you know, we're the disappearing generation. We're down to less than 5 million out of 16.5 million who served in World War II. And every day we lose 1,200 more. So we're the disappearing generation.
I think he called them the greatest generation because there was a real idealism in that generation.
I think there was, and there was unity and cohesion and all the other things. Stars in the window and gold stars in the window. Everybody made sacrifices. Today, no one sacrificed except the poor, and I don't say poor, but the men and women in these hot spots and their families. You don't sacrifice. I don't sacrifice. So it's much different.
Did you look at any of the other World War II memoirs when you were putting this together?
Well, I get a lot of those. Having chaired the World War II Memorial Commission, and we dedicated the memorial last May 29th in Washington, D.C., we raised a total of $195 million to do it. It didn't come from the federal government. And a lot of people sent me their books, World War II guys who many times didn't write them for publication. They wrote them for their family. And they like to sell them, but they didn't know how to sell them. And if you don't have a pretty good publisher helping you, it's pretty difficult.
Did any of them touch something in you, remind you of your own experiences?
Well, there's some in my own division talked about, what is it, can't think of the first word, but something on skis, and that was the 10th Mountain Division. Of course, that reminded me of, but I was only a replacement. I was only in the division about 7 weeks before I was injured. But, yeah, some of, you know, just the fact that they were in the Army, they were separated from their families. They had the same desires. They wanted to get it over with and go home. Nearly all the books are similar to that extent.
You've returned to Italy and to the site where you sustained your injuries a number of times. In fact, I gather most recently this past November.
Right.
Is it a mixed emotions experience when you go there?
Well, not so much. I've been there. It was the first time I visited there, which is, Jiminy, way back. And I think I was in the house in the 60s. And I met a lot of people there and kept up a friendship with them. But most of them are now gone. I think I've been there 5-6 times. So the last trip was not really so emotional because I'd been there. We kind of tried to retrace the steps where I'd been. It was actually a good experience, but not a particularly emotional one.
Well, they put up a plaque. That must have...
They have a plaque honoring the 10th Mountain Division. When I ran for president in 96, the little town of Casteldiano had all kinds of Bob Dole memorabilia and yard signs and everything else that you use in a campaign. So there are nice people there.
Then last January, you fell, and the injury brought you back to... The Army hospitals. You were in a bed at Walter Reed Army Medical Center, where you'd been almost 60 years earlier recovering from your war wounds. Did it feel like deja vu?
Yeah, sure it felt. In fact, I couldn't feed myself. I had to have people help me to the bathroom, and that can be humiliating, though it's necessary. And I said, boy, that's a good way to dramatize the book, but we didn't do it for that reason. I simply fell in my bedroom moving an empty suitcase on January 11th of this year, and I end up with a blood clot. My left arm was about as big as my leg. I couldn't move it. My ankles would swell like balloons. I mean, I had all kinds of problems.
You hurt your eye as well, didn't you? You cut your eye.
I cut my eye, where your glasses have those little templates or whatever they're called, mm-hmm. and sliced down my eyelid. But my left arm, I have to have I don't use my right arm, so when I couldn't use my left arm, I was just about where I was in 1945.
That must have scared the heck out of you.
It scared me, and particularly when one doctor who will remain unnamed was trying to be very nice to me. He said, "Senator, I don't think you're going to get much more use out of that arm." And I said, "I don't have any use at all." He said, "Well, I hope I'm wrong, but I think you've got some very serious injuries to your shoulder." So it turned out somebody was watching over me, and I can lift it up to here. I can comb my hair now, and I can get a tie on after a struggle. So,
I suspect that with the kind of will that you applied after the war,
you'll
be back to being able to raise your arm even.
But again,
higher.
I've had a lot of help from a lot of nice people. So
you've had a number of losses, physical, personal, political, in your life. But you say that things always look different in retrospect. Well, right now you're in the middle of this recovery, but
yeah.
Do you think it'll it'll feel similar to what happened before? You can't just keep on putting a happy face on everything.
I don't know. I think the happy face is I'm getting better, and that's obviously important to me. And I still at 81 hope I can be productive and help somebody along the way. And I'm in a law firm named Alston and Byrd, along with Senator Tom Daschle, who from South Dakota, who just joined our firm recently after his loss last November.
Do you have any advice for dealing with that kind of a loss for him?
Well,
you've had your own experience.
In fact, I saw President Clinton this morning. We were both doing the Today Show, and I happened to and gave him one of my books. We've become very good friends. I think he would agree since all the political shootouts in 1996. And, of course, Tom Daschle's been a longtime friend of mine. So I went up to see him and sort of said, "You know, Tom, it's a lot more fun winning, and as I've experienced. But if you ever think about joining a law firm, why don't you come by and talk to the people in Alston and Byrd?" And he did that, and he had many opportunities. But he, lucky for us, he chose our firm.
Well, you sound a lot less partisan than some of the people in Washington these days. Does it sadden you that it's become so polarized?
Yeah, it's going to take something to break the ice up there. I mean, both sides, it's not limited to either one side or the other. And I think the president's going to have to get more involved. I mean, I always thought if I were president, I knew how the Congress worked. I'd put my arm around the leaders in both parties, and I would be there for breakfast, dinner, or lunch and dinner if necessary, because without their cooperation, you can't move legislation.
But we seem to be having problems along those lines as well.
Yeah.
People have accused this administration of actually pushing things into an even more polarized situation. Right now, a number of people up before Congress who some people take as a kind of like a rubbing it in their face.
Oh, you don't. Well, the judgeships, I think that's going to come to a head one of these days. And I don't think, I know Senator Schumer is from New York, and in 2000 he said one thing when they were talking about Clinton judgeships. Now he's saying just the opposite, that they're Bush nomination.
And the Republicans are doing the same thing on the other side.
There's no consistency in either side. But I do think that you're entitled to a vote. If somebody, if you nominate me for a job, it ought to be settled by the whole company, not just a little committee that might be appointed. So
I guess the thing that I was leading toward is a number of people who have served the country in the military have had their patriotism called into question.
I wouldn't do that. I don't know who's done that, but if they
Max, I've forgotten his name. Who lost?
Oh, Max Cleland. Oh, he's another friend of mine. Yeah.
And he was called. His patriotism was called into question. Lost his seat as a result.
Well, I think he lost his seat because he opposed. Again, I'm not there, so don't judge me on this. On Homeland Security, and I think there were some things said in the campaign. But I remember in 1996, Senator Kerry saying that, well, being a veteran didn't make any difference because, I was running and I was a veteran and Clinton wasn't. So then he was saying, oh, well, being a veteran doesn't really make any difference. And in the year 2004, he based his whole campaign on being a veteran. So inconsistencies, you can buy them by the dozen.
Well, just one more thing along those lines. Yeah. Some people say that that's all because campaign advisors have just too much power. Was that a problem for you?
Right. Yeah.
When you were running,
yeah.
Did you have everybody giving you different kinds of advice?
Yeah, a lot of it. There was some, not much of it must have been good because we lost. But yeah, that's what you hire these consultants for. And I think in Senator Kerry's position, he talked too much about the war. I mean, I think you're proud to be a veteran. Okay, let's move on. Because a lot of people in the audience may not be veterans, not because of any fault of theirs. They may be doing other things just as important. But consultants, they're necessary, but sometimes they're not too good.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
Leonard, thank you. I appreciate it.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
John Kerry and Teresa Hines Kerry have teamed up to write a book called This Moment on Earth, Today's New Environmentalists and Their Vision for the Future. It's published by Public Affairs, and I'm pleased it has brought them to my show today. And since you don't need a real introduction, I didn't write one. Didn't you meet on Earth Day?
1990. You're right. My late husband introduced me to John.
So does that mean that you've both been involved in environmental issues for a while now?
Quite a long time. Mm-hmm.
Do you think the movement has changed since you started looking at these issues?
Absolutely. You know, when we started, I think Teresa and myself, it was new. It was really 1970 when I'd just come back from Vietnam. And we organized Earth Day, 1970, the first Earth Day. 20 million people came out in the streets and said, we've had enough.
When you say we organized, who do you
mean?
Well,
we hold groups of people all around the country. I mean, I wasn't a principal organizer. I was one of the kids doing some work up in Massachusetts. A wonderful friend of mine named Dennis Hayes had left school and was working with Senator Gaylord Nelson, and he was one of the main organizers nationally. But it just was the culmination of people's growing, budding frustration with rivers like the Cuyahoga River that lit on fire and irresponsible congressmen voting against the environment and so forth. They took things into their own hands, and that was the birth. And we've been at it ever since.
And despite all of that, and despite evidence from many scientists, there are still some people, including at least one or two in Congress, who deny that there's any climate change to
yes.
worry about or that we have any problems to face with the environment. Why do you think that is? Is this just simply a political thing? Is it an economic thing?
It's a combination. Number one, I hate to say it, but it's it's just an unwillingness to really grapple with reality. Some people will call it ignorance. Some people will call it arrogance. Some people will call it indifference. Some people will call it ideology. Whatever the combination thereof, it prevents people from taking science and digesting it properly.
Well, what happened in Congress? Well, Al Gore, you served with Al Gore when you were both in the Senate,
yes,
didn't you? And then he was vice president.
Correct.
Did people talk about these things?
Oh, sure. But unfortunately, mostly among ourselves, i.e. those of us on the Democratic side of the aisle now, are deeply concerned about these issues. There are a few Republicans who have offered some concern. But we still do not have a sufficient majority to be able to break out and do a carbon-wide cap, an economy-wide carbon cap, which we need. We still have senators, some of them believing this is a hoax. James Inhofe of Oklahoma. We have some who are still leery of the economic costs and won't weigh in and take stock of the cost of not doing anything. I mean, as we make very clear in the book that we've written, which is called This Moment on Earth for a reason. It's because this moment is as critical a moment to both Therese and me as any we can think of recent time.
Now, Therese, as I remember, you grew up in Mozambique. Do you see a different cultural attitude towards conservation and the environment here in the United States than in other places you've lived?
Well, I think as a movement, as it was, this country is far ahead of any country, really, for quite a long time, until rather recently. What I did get from, and I think what other smaller countries get from their environment, from their surroundings and their lives, is an early and quick understanding of finiteness, what it means not to have something because you don't have it, and therefore I think a more integral respect for both the symbiosis and the give and take and the behavior within our surroundings, whether in my case in Africa, preventing disease, which would not have a cure, would probably kill you, or not getting respecting nature in terms of animals, so you don't go and get yourself into a lot of trouble. Just laws that are common sense laws there. I think this country's been so well off, and so is, and generally so well off, and so huge, that the nearness and immediacy of those that behavior and those needs is not relevant. I mean, not even obvious to a lot of people.
Well, you say we started earlier. Is this kind of like the women's movement, where the United States was at the forefront, and yet we have never had a woman president, and a lot of other countries that we might call a lot more backward have had women in
the
top post?
I look at that. Yes, there's actually, and I've thought a lot about this, there is a parallel trajectory there. America's had something that no one else has had, which is great civic life and volunteerism, which gave structure and place of and power to women who otherwise would not have to be at the forefront of working outside of the home. In Europe or in the other parts of the world, if you work outside of the home, there's a reason for it, or there was. Otherwise, you're minding your children, etc. And so women became engineers or became doctors a lot and early, and prime ministers, etc., because they chose to do that. And so I think, in as much as women have had a lot of power in this country, you know, real power, it's not been the acknowledged parallel to some other countries for those reasons.
My guests are Teresa Hines Carey and John Carey, and they have collaborated on a book called This Moment on Earth, Today's New Environmentalists and Their Vision for the Future. You describe a decentralized environmental movement. Does that mean that our government, in your opinion, needs to take some action?
Of course. Government has failed miserably. And the stories of this book are the stories of people, individuals in the country, who have seized the initiative where the government has offered none, or in many cases fought the government against a counter-initiative. I mean, I give you, there's a wonderful story in the book. We think it's wonderful, which is why we chose this woman, a woman by the name of Helen Redout out in Yakima, Washington, who's a cherry farmer. And her surroundings, her farm, and her general quality of life were being attacked by the dairy farms, these confined animal operations that are big business, where they produce this unbelievable amount of waste, live in misery, and stacked in, no free-range grazing, anything. And the pollution from that was spilling off into their rivers, killing their fish, polluting the air. They fought for 7 or 8 years just to finally get to the point of having a hearing. The government didn't do anything. They went to the Washington Environment Ecology Department. Nothing happened. Only by persisting did they finally hold people accountable to the Clean Water Act, and ultimately had to go to court, and they had to sue in order to have that accountability. It's a great story of individual perseverance and of what we need in terms of accountability in the country.
Well, you fault the Bush administration at times for ignoring climate change, but this is not a book, you say, that's centered on politics. In fact, can't the Democrats be held culpable in any number of areas?
Oh, absolutely.
Fuel emission standards. The Democrats from Michigan, for example, seeing the car industry as something important to the economy of their state, they have invariably voted against fuel emission
standards.
Well,
you're talking to somebody who's particularly sensitive about this, because I brought that initiative to the floor of the Senate with John McCain, And we actually went down in votes from the votes we'd had a previous year. I think we got about 35 votes. And one senator came to the floor with a big blow-up poster on the floor of a Volkswagen, a purple Volkswagen in a field towing a plow, arguing that if we invoked standards, this is what was going to happen in America. I mean, it's crazy. So we're very sensitive to that, sure. The both sides are culpable. But the bottom line is this. This book is particularly not a sort of political book. It's a book about real Americans in different parts of the country, in Mississippi, in right here in the Bronx, a young woman who did an amazing job of fighting to preserve Hunts Point, in South Carolina, in New Mexico, Colorado. Americans are feeling this absence of government accountability, and they're fighting for their own rights.
Well, we can do things like using fluorescent light bulbs or putting panels on our roofs and engaging in this kind of individual activity, but really not much is going to be done until the government gets involved. And it is a political thing. President Clinton didn't sign the Kyoto agreements in 1999 because he said Congress was not going to go along with it.
Well, they weren't. Congress was not, in fairness.
Shouldn't he have signed it anyway just as a symbolic act?
I think symbolism wasn't what was important there. What I think was important there was an effort to bring the less developed countries to the table and to get those less developed countries to agree to something. I think there's a lot the United States could have done during that period to make that happen, and we didn't. The bottom line is that you have to move now, but what we try to do in the book is get people to understand you don't have to lose your quality of life, folks. You may make changes, but you will, in fact, improve your quality of life in the end because you can save money through conservation, through energy efficiencies. You can have the same heating. You can have the same, in other words, you can have the same level of heat. You don't have to wear sweaters and go cold. That's not what people are arguing. We have to put the technologies in place that preserve the standard of living, but do it efficiently and effectively. And other countries are way ahead of us on that. You walk up to an escalator in Japan or some other places, it may not be moving when you get near it. And you say, what's this? Is it broken? Well, you get near it and it starts moving. You get off it, it stops if nobody else is coming. I was in Europe not so long ago for a conference. You walk out of the hotel and the hotel hall is dark. Poof, the lights go on and they come up while you're walking through the hall, seriatim, corner to corner, and then they go down. They save energy. We don't even try to do that in most parts of our country. So there's huge money to be made. There are jobs to be created. There's health to be gained. And there's security to be gained by becoming energy independent.
And the EU has made significant pledges to mm-hmm. cut down on greenhouse gas emissions. Would we gain some diplomatic capital if we did the same sort of thing?
We would. I don't think we can expect... Since we are in a position of leadership, we cannot expect other countries, particularly those that are poor, to hear us with any kind of appreciation and trust if we don't, if we're not part of the game, if we don't make our own commitment to change. But I wanted to go back to something that you asked John, talking about being political, not being a political. This is about people. I agree. It is about people. But I think one of the things that you've done and I've done in my chapters is to try and show, as the book is written, as the stories are told, show the laws that cover certain particular issues, where they have regressed, why they were created, when they came about, are they applied? You know, there are some very good laws in the books that are not applied. So people will say in defense, well, you know, that's covered in the laws. And you can say, indeed, but it's not applied. So where's the will to apply and what obstructs it? And people need to understand that because if they know there's a law, then they should be able to fight it.
My guests are Teresa Hines-Carey and John Carey. Their book, This Moment on Earth, Today's New Environmentalists and Their Vision for the Future. It is published by Public Affairs, and we will continue our conversation right after this. Thank you.
We're back with John Carey and Teresa Hines Carey, their only book. This is their first collaboration. Maybe there'll be others. Is a book called This Moment on Earth, Today's New Environmentalists and Their Vision for the Future. It's published by Public Affairs. You've been talking about individual actions, but as opposed to governmental actions. But governments have been involved, except on the local level. For example, the city of Portland, Oregon, has addressed greenhouse gas emissions. They've announced a plan to reduce them by 10% by 2010. You have California passing a lot of laws. But do they really mean anything if this isn't done on a national level?
The answer is it does mean something, yes. Does it mean enough? No. I mean, the bottom line is you can't solve the problem of global climate change unless you have not just a national effort by the United States, but an international effort. China is poised to build one pulverized coal-powered plant per week over these next years. If they do that, go home. Forget about it. Just sit there and wait for everything to happen because it's all going to happen. We all are bad. We can't allow that to happen, and we have to begin here. Now, we did. There were 11 plants about to be built down in Texas by TXU. People began to raise hell about it. Finally, TXU negotiated. You may have seen this Colcravis takeover deal recently. Part of the deal with the environment community was they can't build those 11, and they're not going to, but they're still building three that will not be according to the standards we need. So you have to prevent on an international scale, and the only way you'll get there is for the United States of America to take the lead.
But haven't we been relaxing pollution standards in this country?
Yes. Bush administration's gone backwards.
But when you speak to countries like China and India or Brazil, other countries that are trying to speed up their industrialization, they say, you know, you really did terrible things to the environment and you got yourself into industrialized status. And now you're telling us we can't do the same thing. I mean, it's very easy for you to tell us not to denude our forests when you've already destroyed all your own.
But first of all, several things there are not true. Number one, we're not telling them they can't do what we did in terms of growing. This is the great red herring. It's a phony, it's a straw man. It gets set up there. And secondly, we're not telling them that we have not destroyed all our forests. We, in fact, have sustainable forestry in many parts of the country, thank God, today. But the Bush administration is doing its best to undo that by undoing the roadless rule and allowing additional forest deforestation to take place. But here's the bottom line. The bottom line is that we can grow, and we tell people this. I've sat with the Chinese, with the delegations at these conferences, and indeed, they believe there's a Western conspiracy to sort of prevent them from growing. We have to make it clear to them how we can help with technology, with technical transfer, technology assistance. We can help them have guarantees of their ability to develop, but to develop clean, to develop sustainably. And it's the complete absence of that kind of leadership that has left us in this dire straits we're in today.
Now, you talked about the Bush administration relaxing standards. Now, what is the justification that it's an anti-business thing to apply standards that improve the environment?
That's what they argue, sure.
Now, I'm sure that there are many Republicans who don't want to have dirty air and don't want all of our coastlines flooded because of global warming.
In theory, yes. But you know what they do? They take a back seat and refuse to stand up to the pressure of the business interest.
And the easy way is to always equate that with loss of jobs.
But we're seeing corporations announcing plans to lessen their environmental footprints.
Because a lot of corporations, corporate leaders, have now come to the conclusion this is real, they have to do something, and they are impatient, and they're not waiting for the government to take action. So you have U.S., you have the U.S. cap. This group of corporations have come together to put a cap in place.
I guess as long as we are talking about politics, my question is, really, would it be much better if a Democrat were in the White House? We didn't see major improvement during the Clinton years. We haven't seen it during previous Democratic administrations, even though we've been concerned about the environment for a very long time.
Well, I don't want to go backwards, but I'll tell you right now, point blank, it would have been very different if we had won that one additional state. And I was determined, absolutely determined, to put this back on the agenda internationally, and I would have led the United States to a very different position. I had committed to put $1 billion into the auto industry for retooling. We would have had a $3,000 or $4,000 per automobile tax credit for hybrids. We would have invested several $1 billion directly into clean coal technologies immediately. We wouldn't have allowed the building of one pulverized coal plant without the ability to capture and sequester. We would have been very firm about those things, believe me.
I think the big factor here is that once you start to define the problem as an economic loss, people just put their feet down and it's like talking terrorism. They don't think anymore. And the whole question here is, America's always done well because they've taken risks, they've invented, and they've gone ahead. And these guys are saying, we got to go back where it was safe once, instead of saying, what's tomorrow going to bring?
Well, you describe the cost-benefit analysis of climate change that Sir Nicholas Stern has done in the United Kingdom. How costly could global warming become?
Unaffordable. Catastrophic. I mean,
5 to 20 times the cost of doing something about it.
Yeah.
Now, if Britain is our closest ally, is this not being transmitted to Washington?
Not well, I guess. At least not being heard. It's surprising, isn't it? But I mean, I always say to people who get to be naysayers, I say, you know, the great friend of President Reagan was British Prime Minister Maggie Thatcher. And Maggie Thatcher very soon on understood global climate change. And she did because she was a chemist. She studied chemistry. She understood the science. And it had nothing to do with being a conservative politician. It was science. And why our country, our leaders right now, don't see that? Is it because they don't understand chemistry? Or is it that they are stubbornly attached to one way of being, almost like Victorian politics, I guess, instead of being forward-thinking?
My guests are Teresa Hines-Carey and John Carey. Their book, This Moment on Earth, Today's New Environmentalists and Their Vision for the Future, is published by Public Affairs. Now, why didn't environment and climate change play a bigger part in your 2004 campaign? It seems to me that Americans are suddenly talking about this now, perhaps because of Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth, perhaps because of news stories that have suggested that pretty much all scientists, other than James Imhoff and a few others, are saying that this is the real deal. But why do you think Americans were not interested in this as a political issue, or was there some other determining factor in not only keeping this less than on the front burner during your campaign, but during Al Gore's campaign as well?
Well, let me begin in the first place with Al Gore. Al and I served on the Commerce Committee together, and we held the first hearings on global climate change in 1987. And Al has done a superb job of leading, of helping to educate America and the world, really, about global climate change. And I give him a lot of credit for it. Al also writes a very nice blurb on the back of our book in which he...
The only blurb you got, in fact.
It's the only blurb we cared to put out there. We thought it was an important one because Al has been a leader on this, but he basically makes it very clear that this is important, number one, and that he shares this broader view. This is not just about global climate change, it's about a broader array of choices that we face. And it's about people. It's about other people and the things that they're doing. But to come back to your point about the campaign, we tried like crazy. I mean, there was not one state we went to, not one stump speech I gave, I mean not one, that I did not talk about the environment.
So is it the press's fault?
Partly, to some degree, but also we lived in the age of 9/11 in the 2004 race. And everything was conditioned by red alerts and orange alerts. And the administration was very clever at keeping America, on the edge of fear. And that was the weapon they used most effectively with respect to the campaign. We even advertised. I was the first presidential candidate to advertise in the primaries on energy independence, on Earth Day, I went to Houston, Texas, and gave a major speech about energy independence, global climate change. Every state we went to, Iowa, we did hog farms, nitrate overload into the Mississippi River. In California, we did offshore drilling. In Minnesota, we did wind farms. In West Virginia, we did clean coal technology. You name the state, and we tried to address those key issues. But somehow the dots didn't get connected in the context of Iraq, the war on terror, Osama bin Laden, and the fears people were made to feel.
Well, it's my sense that the next presidential campaign will be largely about Iraq and also perhaps health care and a couple of other things, but
I don't think
not
so
the
time.
Environment.
I don't agree with that. I honestly don't. And we're hoping it's one of the reasons we've written this book is to talk about people that most of the media would write off at first blush as not being people who might care about the environment. For instance, there's a story in the book about this incredible individual down in North Carolina named Rick Dove, who's a 67-year-old ex-Marine. Or you're never an ex-Marine, he's a Marine. And he, when he retired, he and his son bought some commercial fishing boats to fish. They had three boats. They're out there in the Neuse River fishing. He loved what he's doing. Suddenly he finds he's developing sores, wounds on his own hands, and he sees these fish floating by, dead. Also with these wounds, and some of the fishermen are having memory loss, some of them passing out, not finding their way home. What's going on here? Well, it's all come from the hog waste that is pouring directly out into the river. So this Marine has now become a river keeper, full-time, every day, protecting the Neuse River from people who pollute, from direct pollution. And these are the kinds of stories of these local heroics by people you'd least expect it from. You know, not a tree-hugging, elite, liberal, whatever you want to call it, but a real down-to-earth, average American who's fighting for their backyard. Same thing in South Carolina, where the duck hunter, you couldn't duck hunt in South Carolina today if they didn't raise farm-raised mallards. In 44% of our river bodies in the United States of America, you can't fish or swim. So this is kind of, you know, wake-up time for people to say, oh, if Rick Dove can do this when he retires from the Marines, if Helen Redoubt can do this for 20 years as a farmer, if all these people can go out and fight, then the rest of us can. And this book is sort of a how-to.
Can I move on to another subject for just a moment?
Sure.
Because, Teresa, I've been thinking about presidential wives and how much more prominent they have become, not just the wives of presidents, mm-hmm. but of candidates, Hillary Rodham Clinton, Elizabeth Edwards, especially right now, Mitt Romney's wife, and mm-hmm. you. Do you think that the focus on the wives is a good thing?
That's a good question. I think focus should be meaningful, should be substantive, and should respect the individual in terms of their abilities. You know, there's some wives that have certain qualities to put forth, and there are others that have other qualities, and so you can't put them all on the same stage at the same time, maybe.
Well, I'm assuming that wives were just as smart in the past, and some really got involved in politics. And, mm-hmm. Woodrow Wilson's wife sure did, but Eleanor did. But now they seem to be part of the campaign in a way that they may not have been in the past. And I wonder why in feminist America, why we're even discussing things in the way that we were, and why you became an issue in the campaign, why Elizabeth Edwards' cancer becomes an issue in a campaign rather than just simply something that people would sympathize with her for.
Well, I believe that the nature of media today is different from what it was 20 years ago. And I've been in Washington for 36 years in politics, my late husband and now. It's just very different. And I also believe that national media is very different from local media. And I know that the coverage that you get when you're out in some state, in some city, whatever it is, generally speaking, what it is you talk about and why you came, not the, you know, the kind of the umbrella characterizations or caricatures or whatever. That's not what people really want. So it's different and it's tough. And, you know, we just saw our wife of our governor in Massachusetts, as you probably read, very bright woman, lawyer, new governor's wife, and she's hospitalized right now with a big depressive case.
Was.
I mean, maybe just came home. The point is, there are things which, for better or for worse, no one expects, because no one's been trained for this. And it's a good question. I don't really know how to answer it.
And just one for you, John. When the Democrats became the majority in Congress, there were all these pundits who said, don't get too partisan. We don't need any witch hunts in Washington. Do you think that that's good advice, or do you think
yes,
that—
Yes, I do.
Because there are people who are saying that there needs to be more accountability, and when
well,
you start doing investigations—
You know, accountability doesn't have to be a witch hunt. I mean, look, there are. Give me a department, and I'll give you things that ought to be investigated, frankly, over the last few years. But that's not what we're doing, and that's not what we're going to do. Now, this Justice Department issue is one you can't walk away from. And so, yes, there's some investigation going on. But on the other hand, you know, the Republicans are trying to make it seem like that's all that's happening. It's not. There's a huge amount of work going on and a lot of different issues. We just had a very important debate about Iraq and a very consequential vote. You know, last year I led the effort to bring that same resolution to the floor. We got 13 votes on setting a date. This year we got 48 votes. And I believe that if this continues, there will be more votes. And ultimately this has to have an impact on the administration.
The reason that it can have an effect is because the public has turned on the Iraq war.
Well, the public turned quite some time ago, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, the president has 33% approval ratings. That is pretty low.
I would think
that would be emboldening Democrats an awful lot right now.
Well, look, with all due respect and in fairness, we shouldn't decide what we're doing based on poll numbers. I didn't decide that when I opposed the war several years ago. And when I said during the presidential campaign, wrong war, wrong place, wrong time. And so you have to go out and say what you believe. Now, I think that there's a deeply held sorrow in the Congress on a daily basis as we watch these casualties continue. I was at a wake in Boston just yesterday, day before yesterday, you know, it's just horrible to see more and more of these kids coming back at a time when you know the fundamentals of this war are mistaken.
John Carey and Teresa Hines Carey's book, This Moment on Earth, Today's New Environmentalists and Their Vision for the Future, is published by Public Affairs. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you. Thank you so much.
John McCain's grandfather and father were four-star admirals in the United States Navy, the first father-son admirals in U.S. history. John McCain III would not make admiral. Perhaps it was the 5.5 years he was forced to spend as a POW in the infamous Hanoi Hilton that led him to take a different course. He left a distinguished military career and later served 2 terms as a congressman from Arizona and then was elected to the Senate. Through the early months of this year, he traveled the roads of the primary states in the Straight Talk Express as a maverick Republican presidential candidate. Senator McCain visits today on the occasion of the paperback release of his bestseller from last year, Faith of My Fathers, co-written with Mark Salter. It is a story of how and why John McCain became the man he is today, and I'm very pleased to welcome him to New York & Company. Hello.
Thank you. It's great to be on the program and in the company of some real authors. So thanks for having me on.
How much of this did you write?
Mark and I wrote it together, but Mark wrote most of it. We've been together for 11 years now, so we know each other very well. But it's really his talent that shows through in that book.
The cover photograph on the book shows your grandfather and father standing together on the day of Japan's surrender. Your grandfather was a highly decorated commander. Your father would eventually command all the naval forces in Vietnam. Do you think that their great success placed an unfair burden on you?
No, I think it, clearly I rebelled against it, but that was my failing rather than theirs. Later in life, they gave me an example to live up to, particularly when I was incarcerated. So it's a two-edged sword coming from a well-known family, at least in the circles in which I traveled, which in those days were the Navy.
Well, when you were incarcerated, were you mm-hmm. really thinking, oh, my family goes back in the armed forces since before the Revolutionary War? I suspect you weren't thinking about those kinds of things.
What I was thinking is that if I didn't do my best to live up to standards, which, by the way, I did not always attain, then there was an embarrassment that might accrue to my father and or grandfather. My father was commander-in-chief of all U.S. forces in the Pacific, and the Vietnamese, therefore, gave me extra attention. But
and you were front page news, so you mm-hmm. weren't just going to slip by. Anything mm-hmm. you did was going to be known by everybody.
And obviously, the Vietnamese thought that I was more valuable for propaganda purposes. But at the same time, it made me have some confidence that they want to keep me alive, too, which others didn't have that confidence.
Well, they did this odd thing. They offered you your freedom for propaganda. Now, why didn't they just take you over to the DMZ and say, here you are, move across or we'll shoot you?
You know, that's a very excellent question. And the reason is because they wanted me to sign some kind of statement or make some statement of gratitude. When they offered me the release, they said I wouldn't have to do anything like that. But once you get closer and closer to freedom, I wasn't confident of my total ability to resist doing that. Clearly it was for propaganda reasons. Otherwise, they would have taken the first POW, Everett Alvarez, and released him. So it would have been hard for me to resist just making a statement or a comment, and I don't think I could have done that.
Now, one of the shocks in the story is what happened with your father and your grandfather after the surrender of the Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
You were
mm-hmm.
you born then?
Yes, yes.
You had to be a little.
I think 8 years old when mm-hmm. when the war was over.
And so you're 63 now.
I'm 64 now, actually, and I remember my grandfather vaguely because I remember that he used to roll his own cigarettes with one hand. He had sacks of Bull Durham, and he was quite a colorful character. And yeah, at the end of World War II, my father and grandfather were together because my father was a submarine commander, had taken a Japanese submarine into Tokyo Bay. My grandfather was on the peace signing on the Missouri. They met that day, and my grandfather flew home, which in those days took about 2 or 3 days, arrived home and died the day that he arrived home.
He's supposed to go to a party at his house?
They were having a party at his house, and he had a heart attack and died, which obviously is sad when anyone dies, but he had lived a full life and served his country.
When you were shot down over North Vietnam in 1967, how many missions had you flown?
23.
So you had faced a lot of danger by that point.
Mm, some, yes, including a fire on board the USS Forrestal, which basically crippled the ship and killed 135 young men, which was a great tragedy. And I switched from there to another aircraft carrier, the Oriskany.
And when you got out of that plane, you didn't just parachute safely to landing.
No.
You actually were quite hurt when you were caught.
Yes, I was hit by a surface-to-air missile, and when I was still in a dive, and so when I ejected, there was out in the airstream going about 400 miles an hour. I was injured, and fortunately, I landed in a lake in the center of Hanoi, which, by the way, gave very little opportunity for escape and evasion, particularly since I'd broken both my arms and a leg. Another example of the waste of the taxpayers' money. I'd been to 4 escape and evasion schools, and there you land in a lake in the center of a city of 2 million people. It was a difficult experience. Then when I was dragged up on the banks of the lake there, which is called the Western Lake. It's near the center of Hanoi. There's some nice houses there now, by the way.
Because you've gone back.
Beaten rather badly. Yeah, I've been back several times.
Did they know who you were from the start?
No.
Oh, so when they beat you, it wasn't for propaganda reasons.
It was, to start with, it was just an angry mob, and I understand that. I've never particularly resented that. We'd been bombing mm-hmm. Their country, so I can understand that part of it. Then they took me into a prison cell in what we know as the Hanoi Hilton, and it was about 3 or 4 days before they got the information because it was publicized in the United States.
Early on in the book, you write that if you hadn't been a POW yourself, it's impossible to fully understand what it was like. But I could say that about almost anything. I've never been a senator, so I have no idea what that's like. Sure. But is there something really incredibly different about being a POW, or at least a POW under the circumstances that you were one? Must have been different than being a German POW or one in the Korean War.
I think each war was somewhat different. POWs under the Japanese sometimes were very badly mistreated. In Germany, it was a significant survival situation in many respects. Korea was the first encounter where we had with the so-called brainwashing, where propaganda was attempted. In fact, there was a handful of Americans that went to China rather than come back to the United States after the Korean War. A lot of people don't remember that. And then, of course, Vietnam was such a long war. So each, I think, POW experience was different. But the only thing I think is different about it is it's like any other testing experience. You can have testing experiences in your life without being in a prison situation. And you either come out of it a better person or a worse person. It's not a static, you don't come out of it the same. And I believe that I came out of it as a better person, and I believe my friends, who I know best and love most, came out of it better people too. And people say, oh, wasn't it terrible? Yeah, but some of the most uplifting experiences of my life was to serve in the company of these very good and decent men.
They had an epiphany, you say. My guest is John McCain, who with Mark Salter has written his memoir, Faith of My Fathers. You may have bought it when it was released in hardcover last year, and now it's available in paperback.
Mm-hmm.
I know that a lot of marriages break up when people are in prison, any kind of prison. Is it any different when somebody's a POW? Obviously, the pressures for getting back together have to be quite different than if you've been sent away for armed robbery.
I think two things happen. One is that the separation, the actual separation itself, people change and grow. And unfortunately, the instance of divorce is very high, including my marriage. In first marriage ended also. But I also think there was an added strain on many because the Vietnamese didn't release a lot of names. They did a few, cases like mine where I was well known. But some families didn't know whether their husbands or fathers were alive or not, and that's always an added strain on any marriage, to not even know whether they're alive or not.
The book ends in 1973 when you were released, but obviously a lot has happened since then. When did you realize that you wanted to go into politics?
I was assigned my last assignment in the Navy as the Navy Senate liaison officer for the Navy to the United States Senate. And I'd always been motivated towards public service, obviously, but I began to appreciate the enormous power and influence that resides in a serious legislator. And I was very then tempted to enter the political scene, which I did when I went back to the state of Arizona and ran for the House. But I always had in mind that I would like to be a senator as well. I say that with some Senate snobbery.
Some people are very happy to serve in the House and never aim for the Senate, but obviously have more power in the Senate. Were your politics consistent throughout your life? Had they changed as a result of your experience as a POW?
I'm not so sure they changed as much as my experience as a POW, but I think that when I came to the House of Representatives, I really was very well versed in defense, national security issues, et cetera. And I think that was important then, particularly during the Cold War. I think as the years I've been in the Congress, my issues and ideas and views have broadened and, frankly, sometimes changed. I think I've cast some votes when I was first in the House of Representatives that I would not cast today. But I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think we expect to grow and mature and change. One small example, if I could mention it, I've become much more concerned about the environment than I was, and including in my own beautiful state of Arizona.
One of the most gorgeous states in America. I mean, you have the Grand Canyon.
Absolutely, and so many other wonderful places. I'm really concerned about the preservation of the beauty of the West particularly. So, and, of course, I've gotten into a lot more issues and I think broaden my outlook. I hate to use the word moderated because I don't know exactly what that means, but I do think that I have at least broadened my horizons and views. And one of the areas, by the way, is being much more tolerant of the views of those who disagree. Because I think the only way you function successfully in the Senate is to act, at least to some extent, in most issues in a bipartisan fashion.
A lot of people have described you as an atypical politician, and this is an area where you do seem to be quite different, admitting that you made a mistake. I remember after the primaries, you admitted the mistake of not taking a position on the Confederate flag in South Carolina. Most politicians, no matter what it is, will explain why they made the decision, even if it was 30 years ago and they were a totally different person. They'd switch parties, whatever. They still try to always suggest that they've been consistent throughout their lives. Why do you think that is?
I don't know exactly why people are so reluctant to admit mistakes. You make enough mistakes, you're not qualified. But what we're discussing here, for the benefit of our listeners who don't remember it, I refused to take a position on the Confederate flag flying over the state capitol in South Carolina during the South Carolina primaries. After
because you thought that you would lose votes?
Because I thought I would lose votes. And it really haunted me. And look, the time to make those decisions is when it counts. So I seek neither credit nor anything for the fact that I went down afterwards and said, look, I was wrong by not taking a more courageous position on the flag. And it doesn't take any courage after it's over. But I thought it was important at least to set the record straight because I think this was is a very emotional issue and one that I should have taken a more firm position on and didn't.
My guest is John McCain. His memoir, Faith of My Fathers, written with Mark Salter, is now available in paperback. You're listening to New York & Company on AM 820 WNYC, live online at WNYC.org. Now, after you've imagined yourself sitting in the Oval Office, is it difficult to return to being just another one of 100 senators?
No, because I look back on the experience as one that was one of the most rewarding experiences of my life, and with some glaring exceptions, we fought a very noble and good fight. But second of all, I have come back because of the relative success we enjoyed in the Senate with significantly increased influence. And influence over the process is really my motivation for being in the Senate, so I'm pleased that I do have more influence in the legislative process.
You wouldn't have had it before because you were seen as a kind of a maverick?
I didn't have it before, I think, because I had not established a national identity.
But you were the guy who they invited on talk shows regularly.
Yeah, but around the nation. Now my name ID is up nationally. With independents, I'm still the most I'm now the most popular politician, and every House and Senate candidate literally seeks my involvement in their campaigns. So I think what I've been able to achieve is added influence over the process, and that's really been very rewarding.
Now, you weren't the candidate of the establishment Republicans.
To say the least.
But you drew your strongest support from the conservative wing. The National Review really was 100% behind you.
No, that's really not true. The National Review was very strongly opposed to me.
Oh, I thought it was the Weekly Standard was
the Weekly
George
Standard
W.
No, the Weekly Standard was
oh, was you, right. And George W. was the National. Yeah. I flip-flopped it. Yeah. I'm curious about that, too, because George W. Bush has been described as the middle-of-the-road candidate here. Why would he have such strong support from the National Review?
Well, I think that he had the support of the entire Republican establishment. And
very early.
I understand that. Very early.
Why do you think that was?
I think because the Republicans really wanted a winner. I'll never forget watching Pat Robertson on This Week, and Sam Donaldson said, how come you guys and you aren't supporting Gary Bauer? He says and does everything you want. Pat Robertson said, well, it's all about money this time, isn't it, Sam? I thought that was a very revealing statement. But I think the reason why I got some support from the Weekly Standard is because they're run by what we call the neocons, you know, the ones that mm-hmm. are focused a lot on foreign policy, national security issues. And I think there was a view there that I would probably have been a better or more qualified, perhaps, foreign policy, national security leader. But
Most of them are former liberals, also at least the first generation of neocons.
The neocons are a very interesting group of people, and I find them very stimulating to be around because they think a lot, even if we may have some disagreements from time to time. But they really believe there's a role for this country in the world, and I do too. And I think the great danger to the Republican Party, very frankly, is a rise in isolationism.
In addition to Republicans, many independents, people who usually don't participate in primaries, even some Democrats fell in behind you. Do you think it's because of the image that you created? I suspect at least some of those Democrats had no idea where you stood on abortion or gun control, things like that.
I think it was a combination of factors, but and people say, well, it was just your biography. Well, you know, there's other people who have run, in all due respect to my dear friend John Glenn, who had really impressive biographies. I think it was the message of reform. Not one person out of 20 on the street here knows McCain-Feingold. But I believe 19 out of 20 know that the special interests and the big money have taken over their government, and that's reflected in cynicism and even alienation on the part of young voters. I think a couple of other factors were that I worked hard, but another one was that straight talk. In other words, I think people are a little tired of the spinning, which is lying. And when we'd have a town hall meeting, I had 114 town hall meetings in New Hampshire, and somebody said, I believe that we should have a capital gains tax cut first. I'd say, I'm sorry, I don't agree. I mean, we had open and honest exchanges, and so I think people, even though they may not have agreed, respected the fact that I was willing to tell them the truth, and I think that, or the truth as I see it, and I think that attracted independents and even some Democrats.
Do you think you can take credit for the fact that soft money has become such a big issue in the New York senatorial campaign?
I hope that I can take some small amount of credit, but what really takes the credit is that the scandals get worse and worse. There is that we are now awash in American politics in this so-called soft money, the unregulated contributions. It's now legal in America for a Chinese army-owned corporation with a subsidiary in the United States of America to give unlimited amounts of money to an American political campaign. That's disgraceful.
$500 million between the two parties, I gather, this year.
More than the 98 and 96 campaigns combined. And we aren't into the biggest spending part of it yet. And there's going to be more scandals. This latest thing, in all due respect, of the sleepovers in the Lincoln bedroom. And unfortunately, the White House will not reveal the dates that those people stayed there, because I think there's probably a connection between the money and when they stayed, as Maureen Dowd called it, Motel 1600.
My guest is John McCain. We're talking about what's going on in politics, also about his family memoir, Faith of My Fathers, now available in paperback from HarperCollins Perennial. Well, that may be one of the reasons that we see this back and forth on the polls. Just when it looked like Al Gore was starting to pull ahead, now it looks like George W. Bush has evened up again. And it's because the public seems to be responding, your scandal, your idiocy, your mistake, your faux pas, back and forth, back and forth.
And
very
sorry
little about
to say
issues.
A good performance on Oprah. Look, I love Oprah. I think it's a wonderful program. I think she's a wonderful person. She, like you, stimulates people's interest in good books. But I'm not sure that our founding fathers envisioned a good performance on a talk show as what we want. But look, life
isn't fair.
It's worked
both ways.
Sure.
Al Gore kisses Tipper Gore at the Democratic convention. And
Joe Lieberman sings on late night TV and does a very I guess that we are more and more finding a gray area between politics and showbiz. I can draw no other conclusions. But I hope as we reach the end of October, the first week in November, most Americans will say, okay, how is this candidate going to do on Social Security, Medicare? How am I going to be able to educate my kids? I hope it gets back down to that.
So when you went back to the Senate after the presidential campaign, one in which you seemed to outrage many of your fellow Republicans because they felt you should just step in line and you should have endorsed George W. almost immediately after you realized you couldn't win in the primaries, what was their reaction to you?
It was a warm welcome, warmest welcome that I've ever had, and it was quite interesting because a lot of those people who gave me the warm welcome had even come to South Carolina to campaign against me, so it was wonderful.
Because they realized you're an asset for the party?
Yes, yes. Yeah, clearly. I think they felt that I was an asset to the party, particularly with independent voters. And the important thing for me to do, and I have done, is look forward and not back. Americans don't like sore losers in politics. And as far as I'm concerned, I want to work with all these people so that we can perform our duties to the American people.
Al Gore has said that the first bill he would submit as president would ban soft money.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you are now supporting George W. Bush.
Mm-hmm.
Has he suggested anything like that would be on his agenda?
He has suggested some reforms, not enough. He has suggested outlawing corporate and union contributions, but he has not supported putting a limit on individual contributions, which, by the way, is a law still on the books, but that doesn't seem to matter. But I believe campaign finance reform will come, and I want to work with Governor Bush in order to achieve that goal when he's president.
Well, let's say sometime in the future soft money is banned, mm-hmm. that many of those advocacy organizations have gone out of business. Well, that's unlikely, right? They're just going to find another way, aren't they? And maybe should they be even denied a chance to influence the process?
I think we've been through cycles of corruption and reform in America. Clearly, when Teddy Roosevelt was able to get corporate contributions outlawed in 1907, it's because the robber barons were having such an influence on American politics. In 47, we outlawed union contributions because of the overwhelming influence of unions in post-Watergate, the $1,000 contribution limit, et cetera. If we enacted campaign finance reform tomorrow, 20, 25 years from now, there'll be another McCain and another Feingold saying we got to reform the system. So I don't think there's ever going to be permanent reform. But one, we can clean it up. And two, look, if you're advocating lower taxes, you spend all the money you want and say, I want your taxes cut, call your congressman, etc. But if you, in that ad, say, defeat Al Gore or defeat George W. Bush or attacking them personally, then you're not an independent campaign. You are part of their campaign, and therefore you should be subject to the same campaign contribution limits. I'm not telling them they got to be out of business. I'm saying raise your money for your ads in $1,000 chunks.
Whatever happened to free airtime allotted to each candidate? Do you like that idea?
Oh, I love the idea. There's a wonderful man.
But broadcasters would hate it, wouldn't they? They make millions of dollars on this.
Broadcasters are the most powerful lobby in Washington. They got $70 billion worth of free spectrum. I don't know any other owned by the taxpayers. There's a wonderful guy named Paul Taylor. You know, he used to be a reporter for the Washington Post who is devoting his time to this. And by the way, Walter Cronkite is one of the greatest advocates of it. As opposed to newspapers and magazines, when a broadcaster gets a license to use spectrum, they say they will act in the public interest. They sign a piece of paper that says that. Acting in the public interest, to me, seems to be one of the ways you could do that is to give candidates some free time. And whether there's a ballot initiative in California that's kind of interesting. Give candidates vouchers so that they can buy TV time. Well, why shouldn't the broadcaster say, okay, we're going to give you, Joe Smith, 15 minutes between now and November 7th. You take it however you want, during the evening news or, you know, within certain limits. So I believe that free time for candidates is very important. Do I think it's going to happen? No, because I think the broadcasters have incredible influence.
Well, we may go from school vouchers to campaign vouchers. That's a serious issue. You have to leave, I'm told. Unfortunately, you have another commitment following... And I feel really sad about that because I know we have a lot more that we could talk about. But I'm inviting you right now to come back sometime in the near future.
I'd love to come back and just discuss the issues of the day. And this is a wonderful program. I listen to it all the time when I'm in New York, particularly when I want to know what to read.
Thank you so much, John. Thanks McCain. Again. And remember that the paperback version of Faith of My Fathers, written with Mark Salter, is now available in paperback from HarperCollins Perennial.